Hello, everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. Now, we've heard a lot of news about China throughout the years, especially as their economy has been growing, expected to surpass U.S. GDP, you know, in the 2020s sometime. So it's a really interesting topic. We know China's purchasing large amounts of gold, and, you know, there's lots of underlying implications as to, you know, why they might be doing that. But I have a very interesting guest on the line with me today. His name is George Magnus, and he's the author of Red Flags, Why Xi's China is in Jeopardy. And he's done a lot of research on the topic, and we're going to be discussing China today. So George Magnus of georgemagnus.com, you can find his work there. George, thanks for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
No, thank you for having me.
George, if you would, before we get into this, if you would give us a little bit of your story, your background, you know, how you did all that you do. You got quite the resume here. Tell us a little bit how you got started and what inspired you to write this book.
Sure. So I began really as a sort of a rookie economist, only over 40 years ago now. It's quite some time. In my early years, actually, I did quite a spell with Bank of America in both London and for a couple of years, actually, in San Francisco. And when I came back to London, I had a couple of jobs, actually, that ended up me taking a job with a British merchant bank, or investment bank, as we would probably have known it nowadays, called SG Warburg, which eventually became part of the big banking giant called UBS. And I was the chief economist at Warburg's and started going to China to pitch for business, basically. Economists were employed then and still are to go and talk to official institutions and central banks and try to win business from countries in the emerging world, for example. And China was very emerging in those days. It wasn't anything like it was today. And so that first whetted my appetite for China. Anyway, to cut a long story short, when I became the chief economist at UBS, I started going to China probably three or four times a year. I've been visiting there every year since about 1993, 1994. As I gave up my management jobs at UBS and started to have more time to do content and client kind of work, I became more and more interested, and I wrote a book about emerging markets about 5 years ago, which was a sort of an hors d'oeuvre for China, and then really became more and more interested in what was going on, particularly since President Xi Jinping came to power in 2012, and found a meeting of minds with the commissioning editor at Yale University Press, and the rest of it is history, and the book came out late last year.
All right, so red flags. Let's talk about what some of these problems are that you're seeing. And I'm particularly interested in starting here. We know there's been a big demographic issue going on in China. It's been all over the news, and you know, we heard about it in Japan, these one-child policies. Let's start with demographics. Is this where you feel the most important problem is stemming from?
It's probably not the most important, and it's probably not the most urgent, but it's a big issue for China, as it is actually for a lot of other countries. And in many ways, it's not dissimilar from the demographic issues which you have in the United States or we have in Britain, which is basically about the fact that the birth rate isn't high enough to replace all of the people who are marching off into retirement when they reach 63, 4, 5, 6, 7, or whatever the eligible age is. And so you have a kind of a shrinking pool of workers. And this creates all sorts of economic dysfunctions, which they can be, we do have coping mechanisms to try to deal with them. They're not really easy to implement politically. But China's issues here are no different from ours. Where they are different is that they are going to age, so the age structure in China is going to change as much in the next 20 years as it has done in the West and in Japan during the last century. So the phrase getting old before you get rich is one which was kind of invented really for China, because of course they're getting old and they have a very immature social security and healthcare system relative to ours in the West, let's say. And of course they have income per head, which is a fraction of what it is in the United States. So income per head in the United States is over $50,000. In China, it's about $12,000 or $13,000. So although one imagines that China will get a little bit better off in the next, 20 years, they have an enormous issue having to deal with the speed with which the country is getting older.
Well, it's interesting. And that leads me to another question here. How would you classify China's government and its relationship with people and their ability to survive and thrive and to, go up the economic ladder? One thing I'll preface it with is the People's Republic of China has been, ruled by the Communist Party since 1949, since the Chinese Civil War. So, does this mean anything to you? Is this a reason why they might be in for some trouble, or is it the opposite in your opinion?
Well, it's again, great question. And the answer is nuanced, because if you think about what's happened in China during the last 30 or 40 years, it's unprecedented in terms of speed and scale of economic progress and kind of a lurch towards modernity. And just to kind of put people's, to put this into perspective for people, after the Mao era ended at the end of the 1970s, the leadership passed to somebody called Deng Xiaoping, who is widely credited with having used an expression at a major Communist Party conference, in which, talking about the economy, he said that he didn't care whether it was a black cat or a yellow cat, so long as it was a cat that caught mice. And what people kind of have interpreted from that historically is that what he was getting at was that the doctrinaire view about how you run the economy in China, which had prevailed under Mao since 1949, had to change. And of course, it was with Deng Xiaoping that China began to open up and reform economically and to some degree politically. Not that it veered away from kind of state authoritarianism, but it created more flexible structures and market mechanisms were allowed to flourish. Ownership was allowed to change so you could have some kind of private interest in land and agriculture and small companies and so on. So China's progress during the last 40 years really dates from Deng and his successors. And your question is really interesting, and it actually goes to the heart of my book, because in the subtitle of my book, it says, Why Sees China is in Jeopardy? Because things, I think, changed in 2012 with a governance system coming into being in China, which is different from what happened during those 30 or 40 years of dynamic emergence. And it's, in a way, a bit of a throwback to the days of the Mao era, very authoritarian, stifling, top down, the party controls everything, that kind of stuff. And I don't think that governance system is compatible with the goals that China has set itself.
Okay, so in your opinion, then, we've come a little more down the road here for people to have some incentive to produce, because ultimately, it's not, you talked about the black cat or the yellow cat, it just doing the job. Ultimately, the job, I think most people would agree is that, people make more money and people thrive, they have a higher standard of living. That would be the catching of the mice. And to get people to do that, they have to have a reason to want to produce an incentive, a motive. And you believe that there is that incentive and that motive in China. even under this, you know, communist banner or labeling that's over the country, because, you know, if extreme communism, I think, takes away that incentive. I mean, it just, people don't have, you know, they, as hard as they work, there's a limited upside. And I think there's a fundamental problem with that. So, you know, can you speak to that anymore?
Yeah. So, I mean, so the Communist Party of China actually is the ruling party of, and the only party really in China, and it is the government and it is the state. But in a way, there's not nearly as much that's communist about that Communist Party as there was, say, over the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which kind of went into oblivion in 1989. So the Chinese are much more tolerant of the private sector. They're much more, or have been more accommodative of private enterprise and private initiative. And in fact, the most dynamic part of the Chinese economy for the last two or three or four decades actually has been the private sector, which accounts for, you know, 60% of output, 70% of jobs. I mean, very, very high proportions of the economy are attributable to the dynamism of the private sector. The problem that I see in now the, you know, as we move into this towards the 2020s under Xi Jinping, is that the private economy is having to play second fiddle to the state sector. And particularly with this kind of focus that we all have, and particularly the Chinese government on technology and on artificial intelligence and big data and trying to find, you know, the secret to life in the universe from new ways of doing things and new technologies. The top-down guidance, quote-unquote, from the government to not only state enterprises, but to private companies like, for example, Huawei, which has been in the news a lot during recent weeks, which is a private company, but actually it's not a private company in the sense that we understand private companies. So this stifling of private initiative actually has become a problem, which a lot of Chinese intellectuals and professors and even some within the party actually have complained about, because they say that China is giving, or the government is giving, too much weight and too much emphasis to the state sector and not enough to private enterprise, which has been the engine of growth. So we're in a little bit of a kind of a twilight area at the moment, not the same as it was 30 or 40 years over the last 30, 40 years. And we don't really know which way the kind of the balance will settle in years to come.
George, so let's talk a little bit about China's dependence on the US, or the reverse, the US's dependence on China. Who is dependent on who more? And a follow-up question to that is, who has more leverage over who?
Well, that's clearly extremely relevant now with the trade negotiations. Well, truce having been reached in the trade negotiations, or the trade war, I should say. So the truth of the matter is, I think, you know, there is an interdependence, right? Which goes, it's not just economic and commercial, but it's, you know, in the kind of the military sector, in kind of international relations and diplomacy and so on. But I think certainly in the economic sector, obviously a lot of American companies and Western companies, you know, do depend on China's huge market size for very significant shares of their revenues and their earnings, as we've seen recently with Apple's warning from the chief executive about future revenues because of the weakness in China. So there is an interdependence that way of selling goods and services into China. Similarly, there's a dependence the other way, because China depends on selling its products, its exports not just to the United States, but also to the European Union and to Japan and Korea and Taiwan and so on and so forth. So it's a very convoluted and a very complex interrelationship. I don't think that the interdependence is, you know, significantly stronger one way or the other. But when it comes to trade, I think that in a way, the United States timing in calling China out on issues that have been festering for some time, like intellectual property infringement, technology transfer, subsidized enterprises, and so on, it's come at a particularly bad time for China. So if you twist my arm and say, who is suing more for trade peace now? I'd say the Chinese are doing more of that than, say, the United States government is doing, because I think the Chinese need trade peace more than the United States does. I mean, nobody wins a trade war, in my view, but I think the Chinese need to stabilize it more urgently at this particular point in time.
Are you, are you at all worried about China's growth? Is it a problem if they get too powerful? Do you trust them with the military? What are your thoughts on this front? I think there's a lot of like fear that, you know, you can sense with people, like, oh, China's going to get too powerful and do some sort of imperialist sort of attack on the world. Do you believe that in any way, shape or form?
I don't really lose a lot of sleep over whether, you know, China is going to adopt a very aggressive military posture with regard to the US or to, you know, the Western world. I think there are areas where accidents and misunderstandings could happen, you know, like over the islands in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, when, American and other Australian or British warships sail through those areas under freedom of navigation rules. If they're confronted, you know, and there's a lack of communication, and I mean, bad stuff can happen. But I think there are structures in place that, you never say never, but I think there are structures in place that would basically resolve issues like this. I mean, there have been one or two cases, haven't there? Several years ago, I think an American plane was shot down in a kind of a state of confusion in terms of the Chinese military. Things can happen, but I do think that, I fear a lot about kind of a military, the inevitability of a military conflict between China and the West. But I do think there's a high state of tension now, which is whatever happens in the trade negotiations, there's a high state of tension about technology and about the use of technology in military applications, which is going to keep the US and China, for example, in kind of separate and parallel universes in a way that wasn't the case in the last decades. And I think that creates a risk, obviously, that this could spill over into areas where, you know, an absence of control or an absence of scrutiny could allow things to happen that we really wouldn't want. So I think we do have to be vigilant, but I don't think there's anything imminent. There's been a lot of discussion. I think it was a professor at Yale or Harvard called Graham Allison wrote this book called The Thucydides Trap, or a book about the Thucydides Trap and about the inevitability of war between the United States and China. But the book's been widely criticized, and I myself don't see, you know, the Americans and the Chinese don't share borders. If there is an issue between the two, it's probably over, you know, commercial matters more than anything else. I kind of worry about the tension, but I don't think there's too much imminent risk of problem, I don't think.
Okay. That's interesting. I do believe it's going to be a matter of following the money, you know, and talking about the trade tensions that we're seeing now. If China had a bigger stick, would it change the dynamic of what we're seeing? Or is it just, you know, these countries playing cordial? You know, it's only business, right? You know, that's what we say when we're negotiating, doing things with other people. Right. We respect other people, but this is business.
So the one thing I would just add very briefly is I think that we worry often about what a threat a strong China would be to us in the West. And actually, I think the worry is really the other way around. I think it's a weak China would be a much bigger threat to us than a strong China. And part of what I've tried to argue in the book is why Xi Jinping's China is probably more brittle underneath than it looks. So if everything goes right in China, he's a very powerful president. If something goes wrong, which is almost inevitable, then there's only one place the blame can fall, which is him. And that could unleash political or policy instability in China, which we don't really know how to read that or how to follow it, because it's complex, it's opaque, there's no transparency about that. So we have to watch Chinese politics very closely as well.
So, George, there's a lot of talk regarding, you know, China and Russia and India, for that matter, gold purchases, you know, accumulation of these gold reserves. And there is this concern or, you know, speculation that the U.S. and Europe are suppressing the gold prices so that, you know, we do have this confidence in the underlying fiat currencies that, you know, much of the world uses as world reserve currencies. So what are your thoughts on this? Is China preparing for something to happen to these underlying world reserve currencies, specifically the dollar? And would that be the reason why they're accumulating gold to be prepared for a shift in what they use as their reserves down the line?
Not my view, to be honest. I know I've read stuff like this online. But actually, the Chinese, as far as we know, the ownership of gold officially in China actually is quite low compared with what it is in a lot of other countries in the West and also in Asia. So it's a kind of inevitable and to be expected, really, that they would want to try to lift the share of gold in their international reserves. But they have already, you know, over $3 trillion worth of international reserves, the bulk of which, vast majority of which, are in US dollars and other currencies. They're very proud of these reserves. They think it's really the kind of the result of hard work. I mean, that's kind of a debatable proposition. But I think what the Chinese have rhetorically said, particularly after the financial crisis 10 years ago, not so much in recent years, but they have said that they are unhappy with a world monetary system that's dominated by the US dollar, which basically means by the United States. And they are encouraging the use of their own currency, the renminbi, in international trade and in international reserve holdings. And they would like to see it used more frequently. It's an uphill struggle, I would say, because I think the world doesn't have very many reserve currencies over time, and a lot of inertia has to kind of pass by before currencies fade away. So, you know, sterling was a big reserve currency and actually didn't really lose its status until the 1950s. The US dollar is well ensconced as the world's major reserve currency, and I think is likely to remain so for a very long time. But I think what the Chinese would like to see is a multi-reserve currency system where lots of currencies compete as kind of satellites around the US dollar. I think it's a bit of a fantasy myself, but that's what they would like to see one day.
All right, George, any closing thoughts here? Where is your predictions? You know, how do you see this Chinese economy panning out? I know you think it's brittle. What are some of the forecasts or beliefs that you believe China will be going through over the next 10 years or so? And do you accept the premise that China will surpass the US in, you know, roughly 10 years or so in terms of GDP?
So that's the easier bit of your question to answer. So by some measures, China's the monetary value of China's GDP is already bigger than it is in the United States.
By purchasing power, right?
That's right. But if you measure in more conventional kind of current US dollar terms, there's obviously there's still a way to go. If nothing happens to the Chinese economy and the American economy continues to grow at, 2%, 2 and a bit% per annum, I mean, the maths are easy. China's GDP will become larger than America's within the next 5 to 7 years. But what does that mean? And is it important? So size in some respects matters. But actually, if you looked at income per head as a measure of how well off people are and the country is, China is still a long, long way away from the United States. Would take decades, if at all, to catch up. And this presupposes, of course, which brings me on to the first part of the question that you asked me, this presupposes that China can keep on growing at kind of the rapid rates it's done in recent memory, in recent history. And I think that's not possible, because the biggest problem that China has at the moment, we spoke about demographics and aging before, but the most urgent and important problem China has right now is trying to get control of its indebtedness. It's not an indebtedness which they have with respect to foreigners, because foreigners don't really own very much Chinese debt. But it's a domestic indebtedness, just like America's problem of debt in the 2006-2007 was domestic mortgage debt, just like Japan's problem in the 1990s was domestic yen debt incurred by corporations. So China's problem is its domestic debt, not just its corporations, but also households and local governments as well. So trying to get on top of this problem is essential for China. The debt just won't go away. So one way or another, even if China manages to avoid a Lehman's type of crisis because they control and own the banks, the manifestation of getting to grips with the debt problem is much lower growth. And that is my kind of strongest prediction, really, for the next 5 to 10 years, is that we will have to acclimatize, and the Chinese will have to acclimatize to a much reduced rate of economic expansion.
All right, George. And if people want to learn more about you and the work that you do, buy your book, let them know where they can go and what they can find.
Well, you can certainly find everything that I do in the public domain on www.georgemagnus.com. And the book, as you've kindly pointed out, Red Flags, Why Seize China is in Jeopardy, came out in October, and it's a relatively easy to read book, not too many nerdy bits in it, and covers all the things that we've spoken about here and a few more too.
All right, George, and thank you so much for coming on Crush the Street. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. Nice talking to you.